Welcome to Downrange Radio and our ongoing exclusive coverage of the Supreme Court's landmark DC v. Heller decision, which yesterday affirmed that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right. I'm your host, Michael Bain, also the host of Shooting Gallery on the Outdoor Channel. And, of course, Downrange Radio is the audio podcast incarnation of Downrange Television, www.downrange.tv, the voice of the gun culture on the Internet. And, of course, if you go to Downrange TV, that's where we've got all our audio commentaries. Today we have commentaries from David Hardy, the creator of the In Search of the Second Amendment documentary, a fine, fine documentary on the Second Amendment. Also from Larry Keene, general counsel for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, architect of the legal battle against the city suits, and a man who was deeply involved in the Heller case and the NSSF amicus brief. Also from Alan Gottlieb, the Second Amendment Foundation. Now, Alan, of course, Second Amendment Foundation yesterday filed suit against Chicago. It's filing suit against San Francisco. We are going after all the other gun bans out there. And, of course, the name Dave Koppel, it's not a name I have to introduce to you, Dave Koppel of the Independence Institute in Golden, Colorado. He has been on the front lines of the battle for the right to keep and bear arms for years. Also, one of its most articulate. He's one of the more articulate spokespeople. I wanted to follow up with Dave and talk a little bit about how constitutional rights get built, because we tend to think that with the Heller decision, wow, it's all over but the shouting, pop the champagne corks. Well, it's not. That, and one of the things you've heard today again and again is it's the beginning of a long road, and I wanted to talk to Dave and have him step us through that. Here's Dave Koppel. Dave, writing in Reason Online this morning, one of the notes that you made was that Rome wasn't built in a day and constitutional doctrine isn't built in a day. Could you elaborate on that for me?
Sure. And this is a response to some of the people who, I think if you bought them a pony, they'd say, well, where are the twin unicorns in the chariot? saying that Heller doesn't go far enough, that it allows too much gun control, when they really should be celebrating what is the beginning chapter of a new story of constitutional freedom. And here's the legal history background I'd point to. In the First Amendment, of course, was enacted in 1791. From 1791 until the 1930s, the U.S. Supreme Court did essentially nothing to protect the First Amendment. They almost never heard First Amendment cases, and whenever they did, they ruled in favor of the government. So, the First Amendment existed as an ideal. It was in people's hearts. Sometimes legislators acted in response to the First Amendment, but in terms of getting any protection from the Supreme Court for your First Amendment rights, you got none at all. From 1791 until the 1930s. And then in the 1930s, the Supreme Court finally got interested in using its power to take some first steps to protect people from the most abusive violations of First Amendment rights. So you had cases like in Jersey City, New Jersey, where Boss Haig said, no parades in my town, no demonstrations, none of that kind of stuff. Well, maybe if you want to have a parade in my honor, you can do it, but certainly you're not going to have any parade that might criticize me or is by some group I don't like. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Of course, you can have parade restrictions and limits, but they've got to be reasonable time, place, and manner things, like have the parade over by the time it's dark, things like that, pick up your own litter, and you can't discriminate on the basis of the content of the parade. Likewise, there was a case where a state government was so mad at a newspaper, they imposed an enormous tax, I think it was something like 10,000%, on newspaper ink, and defined it so that it only applied to this one large newspaper in the state. And the Supreme Court said, of course you can tax newspaper ink, but you can't do it with this obvious purpose of retaliating for criticism of the government. Now, those are easy First Amendment cases. If the First Amendment's going to protect anything at all, it's going to apply in situations like that. After decades and decades of that First Amendment doctrine being built up case by case and becoming stronger and stronger, we got to the point where, you know, by the 1970s, when the American Nazis wanted to provocatively hold a parade through Skokie, an Illinois suburb, where there were a bunch of Holocaust survivors, and the town tried to stop them, it was by then an easy First Amendment case in the 1970s to say, no, loathsome as these guys are, you can't stop them. And in the 80s and 90s, we similarly had it was a relatively easy First Amendment decision, you know, including for Justice Scalia, to say that you can't ban flag burning because, you know, you're really banning it because you hate the idea that it's behind flag burning, and it is a hateful, disgusting idea, but you can't ban this way of expressing a terrible idea. It would have been ridiculous in 1935 to say, oh, good, well, we got one or two Supreme Court cases in favor of the First Amendment, but look, they haven't done anything about this law that in Texas that bans flag burning. And look, that, you know, and in 1939, a bunch of Nazis want to hold a parade and the mayor stopped him. You know, you weren't going to get the Supreme Court to rush in and protect the Nazis. So you have to, in a realistic sense, rather than living in a libertarian science fiction utopia, expect that the right can expand in a virtuous circle, because when back to the First Amendment, when the court in the 30s began really protecting First Amendment rights, that added to the rights consciousness of the American public and made them take their own First Amendment rights more seriously, and so they grew to have more elevated expectations of the scope of their First Amendment rights, and then as the public became more pro-rights, that gave the court more maneuvering room to further protect rights, and it made legislators more protective in their own actions of free speech and freedom of religion rights, so that instead of maybe so that there were fewer and fewer laws restricting those rights, or the Supreme Court, when it was faced with a bad rights-restricting law, would be in a situation where, oh, this law exists in two or three states, mm-hmm. rather than the law they have in 30 or 40 states. And so the Supreme Court could be bolder in saying, well, we're just striking at the aberration rather than at the norm of American practice. So that this virtuous cycle builds of the Supreme Court participating in a growth of national rights consciousness. And you can tell a similar story about the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which says the state can't deny equal protection of the laws to people. And even though it's, you know, that seems clear enough, that clause was essentially judicially nullified almost all the time from its enactment in the 1870s and through the 1920s. And all kinds of abusive racial discrimination by government was allowed. And the courts almost never did anything about it. And then in the 30s, the Supreme Court again started saying, well, maybe we're going to really take this Equal Protection Clause seriously. And they started with the easy cases. For example, Missouri says no blacks can attend the University of Missouri Law School. And we don't even have a law school in the state for blacks to attend. Well, maybe we'll send them out of state and we'll pay their tuition. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Remember, we said separate but equal in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1898. Well, we mean that. We're going to start really taking that seriously. So if you don't have a law school for blacks, you can't segregate the state's only law school. You could have a black law school and a white law school, but you can't have a black-only school. Or you can't have a white-only school with no opportunity for blacks to go to law school. And that was pretty straightforward even under Plessy versus Ferguson, because it was really just saying, you know, separate but equal really does mean you got to have something that is separate and it's got to be equal. And over time the court would then say, oh, well, look at this law school in say Texas. It is separate, but it's really not equal. They don't have as many professors, their law library is not as good, and so on. And then a while later they'd say, you know what, you can't ever have a segregated law school because making the contacts and networking is such an important part of you know, a lawyer's future success, that if the law school is racially segregated, even if the facilities are exactly equal, that's still a violation of equal protection. And we build from there, after the law school cases, to 1954, where they finally repudiate separate but equal and say, school in Brown versus Board of Education, you can't have deliberately segregated schools. And then it's the next decade after that, in 1966, when the court finally takes on what is the absolute hot button in the whole racial issue, and that is they strike down laws that prohibit black and white people from marrying. And in fact, these laws were not rare ones. They were in at least a dozen states, maybe about 20. That's Loving versus Virginia. In 1936, when the Supreme Court's, you know, just getting started with these easy cases on the law schools, it wouldn't make sense for somebody who was a pro-civil rights activist to say, well, yeah, that's great that now they did something about the law school problem in Missouri, but they haven't even touched Missouri's ban on interracial marriage. And, in fact, the opinion makes it look like they're never going to do something about that. You got to let things build over time. Law is a tremendously conservative institution. I don't mean that in a left-wing, right-wing thing. I mean the whole legal sensibility is of building on precedent. This is the common law system. You take something, you take it a step further, you build and you build and you build. You don't try to have the top story of the skyscraper before you've built every single floor underneath it. And that's where we're going on guns. Heller's the foundation. And we can keep on building if citizens stay active, if the NRA continues to have citizen support and citizen volunteers and all the other gun groups have, you know, or likewise get good support from citizen activists, we can take this foundation of Heller and really build something magnificent on it. But there's just no point in looking at this great foundation we have with Heller and saying, well, it's not 20 stories tall, so I don't even have a good view of the mountains.
So basically, the Heller decision, what that's done is it's put a floor underneath us. It said, you can't ban. But everything that comes after that is going to have to be litigated a step at a time, correct?
Yeah, and there's going to be lots and lots of gun control that's going to be not unconstitutional under Heller. And we're going to have to rely on the political process to uphold Second Amendment values. Just like somebody would say, well, even though the Supreme Court says it's okay for government to censor school newspapers at a high school, we care so much about First Amendment values that we'll enact a special protection for First Amendment for school newspapers. That's what we did here in Colorado. So the legislature's sense of First Amendment values was even stronger than what the Supreme Court would say the First Amendment mandates. And likewise, we can take Second Amendment values further than the baseline that the Supreme Court has set in Heller. And as we do that, the baseline will be raised higher and higher. The building will continue to grow. And instead of going down the slippery slope towards gun bans, we'll be going down a different slippery slope towards greater and greater gun freedom.
Dave, give me your sense of Justice Scalia's sort of enshrining the concept of self-defense as it almost seemed to me a protected value.
Oh, it's enormously important. I mean, this is actually something that's going to have huge implications, you know, much beyond the, you know, and in some ways, maybe over the next 5 years, maybe more impact on American law than the handgun ban, because handgun bans are so rare in the United States. Self-defense is a perfect example of when the Ninth Amendment says that the enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to disparage others, that there were lots of other rights that Americans of the founding era believed they had, and they just didn't want to write them all down in the Constitution because they couldn't. I mean, you know, how long would that list be? So, you know, yeah, do we have the right to wear hats? You know, do we have the right to eat and drink what we want? Do we have the right to go to sleep when we choose and wake up at the hour of our selection? Do we have a right to self-defense? Of course. And all of those are implicit in the Ninth Amendment. But the problem, there has been a problem that's developed, and it's especially in some of the more statist jurisdictions, is to say that treat self-defense not as an inherent natural right, but as something like a government, like a privilege,
right,
which can be withdrawn if the government chooses to. So, for example, you have a court decision that says, well, if you're being attacked illegally by the police, you know they're illegal, they know they're illegal, you know, it's not a question, but they're just, like, beating you up because they're breaking the law. It's illegal, it's, you can't use self-defense against that criminal attack from a government officer. Now, and if self-defense were a mere privilege, which the government can give or take as it pleases, that's a plausible, you know, analysis. What we now have with the Heller decision is self-defense is very clearly a constitutional right, and it has its home in the Second Amendment. Now, it's true the Second Amendment doesn't say self-defense, but let me give you another constitutional analogy. In the 1950s, when the NAACP was doing its great work fighting against the Jim Crow laws in the South, several southern states enacted laws to try to crack down on the NAACP. So, for example, I believe Alabama had a law that said, well, organizations like the NAACP have to give us their membership lists.
Mm-hmm.
And, and you know what that would lead to, because
right,
they'd turn the membership list over to the sheriff's office and the Klan, which were sometimes the same thing. And those members who wanted to keep their identity private would be exposed to terrible danger of violence. Well, the Supreme Court took the case. There's nothing in the First Amendment that says you have a right of association, you know, a right to belong to activist membership groups like the NAACP or the NRA or the Sierra Club or, you know, or the Brady Campaign. But the Supreme Court said, look, there is a right of freedom of speech, and there is a right of assembly explicitly mentioned in here. And from these, it's close enough to see that especially those two put together, and just the general principles behind both, there must be a right of association, too. And so there a right for these voluntary political activist organizations to exist, and to exist in a way so that the government can't destroy them through regulation, as the NAACP, as Alabama was trying to do to the NAACP. So now, under American constitutional law, there is a right of association, and you can find a section on it in the textbooks on First Amendment law, even though it never explicitly says association in the First Amendment. Heller does that same thing for self-defense. The right of self-defense is now out of the shadowy world of the Ninth Amendment and into the bright uplands of the explicit Second Amendment.
I think that's an incredible thing. As I know you and I have discussed this, when you look toward Europe or you look toward England, where the right of self-defense, it's not a right. That, in fact, as I've stated before, all violence is the property of the state. And so if you look in England, anyone who defends themselves violently, even against a violent crime, may well be charged. And it seems to me that, boy, that's off the table here in the United States.
It's off the table in the United States, and it's going. Of course, I mean, obviously there are parameters of reasonableness, and always have been, as in self-defense, and including the, you know, the proportionality of force. I mean, you know, the fact that someone is shoplifting from your house or from your store, you know, doesn't mean you can take out an axe and chop their head off.
Right.
And of course, you know, our self-defense rights had very strong roots in the English common law. And yet that, as you say, self-defense exists in a nominal way in English law, but in practice, it's been essentially wiped out in England. And this is one of the very hopeful things I see for Miller, is there's a long history of American rights expanding overseas and infiltrating things. You know, it's things like in Canada, where people watch a lot of American television shows, and they get the idea they've got all these rights. And even at a time when Canada hadn't enacted its Charter of Rights and Freedoms, this you know, there were some people in the government who was complaining that American TV was making those pesky Canadian citizens too uppity because it gave them this idea they had rights. And that's one of the things that helped lead to the enactment of Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is sort of analogous to our Bill of Rights. And, you know, the American Supreme Court is the most prestigious court in the world. And there's lots of our ideas, especially freedom of expression, freedom of religion, anti-discrimination, fair treatment, due process of law for criminal suspects and in general, that have really had a big impact globally. And not only by influencing courts in other countries, but also by influencing the citizens of other countries to have more consciousness of their own inherent human rights. Heller is a huge step in that direction. You know, our biggest long-term threat in America is this UN anti-gun jihad. And that is not going to end until the people of Norway, England, France, Japan, Germany demand that their governments stop supporting this effort. And to do that, we got to empower the people of countries like that to stand up for their inherent human rights. And I think Heller is a significant positive step in that direction of affirming that you really do have an inherent human right of self-defense.
Dave, I think that is exceptionally well put, and I'm going to let you off the hook now because I know you've got about 1,000 phone calls queued up in other interviews as well. But just one really quick question, it's something I've asked other people, is I know you've been in the front line on the trenches on this a long time. Can you just give me just very quickly a sense of how you felt yesterday morning?
I presume you've read Lord of the Rings?
Yes.
I felt like Sam Gamgee did when he saw the ring falling into the volcano at Mount Doom. It was a long process, and it was just awesome to see it finally happening. And as with destroying the ring and destroying Mordor, it was a very close thing. You know, this was 5-4, but we had the 5, and it was absolutely elating and wonderful.
Dave, as always, great talking to you. Thank you for your work on this issue over the years, and take a day off this weekend.
Well, we've got Independence Institute's Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Day is Saturday, so I'll be shooting, drinking, and smoking, and I'll get to call it work.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Okay, thanks.
As we've said for so many years, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms should be a convenience store, not a government agency. As you can see from Dave, we build our rights. We build our rights on a foundation. Just because the Bill of Rights was included in the Constitution of the United States, all those rights didn't then suddenly spring fully formed, protected into the forms of those rights that we have now. And I think that's a critical point. I'm glad Dave was able to step us through how some of that works, because we are going to be working on building that edifice of the Second Amendment, on building the Second Amendment into a rock-solid wall as we move forward into future years. Of course, you've heard us talk a lot today about the 2008 elections. It's very important who the president is, because he gets to pick the judges, boys and girls. And it was a 5-4 decision, a scary, scary decision. Boy, I'd like to have seen a 6-3, but, you know, I'll take a 5-4. Okay, I am your host, Michael Bain. You are on Downrange Radio, the audio podcast incarnation of Downrange Television. Throughout the day, we'll be producing more audio commentary on D.C. v. Heller, the reaffirmation of the Second Amendment as an individual right. Thanks for joining us.